time. Combining space and time into space-time in this way would be rather trivial if one could disentangle them in a unique way. That is to say, if there was a unique way of defining the time and position of each event. However, in a remarkable paper, written in 1905 when he was a clerk in the Swiss Patent Office, Einstein showed that the time and position at which one thought an event occurred depended on how one was moving. This meant that time and space were inextricably bound up with each other. The times that different observers would assign to events would agree if the observers were not moving relative to each other, but they would disagree more the faster their relative speed. So one can ask how fast does one need to go in order that the time for one observer should go backwards relative to the time of another observer. The answer is given in the following limerick. There was a young lady of white who travelled much faster than light. She departed one day in a relative way and arrived on the previous night. So all we need for time travel is a spaceship that will go faster than light. Unfortunately, in the same paper, Einstein showed that the rocket power needed to accelerate a spaceship got greater and greater the nearer it got to the speed of light. So it would take an infinite amount of power to accelerate past the speed of light. Einstein's paper of 1905 seemed to rule out time travel into the past. It also indicated that space travel to other stars was going to be a very slow and tedious business. If one couldn't go faster than light, the round trip from us to the nearest star would take at least 8 years, and to the center of the galaxy about 50,000 years. If the spaceship went very near the speed of light, it might seem to the people on board that the trip to the galactic center had taken only a few years, but that wouldn't be much consolation if everyone you had known had died and been forgotten thousands of years ago when you got back. That wouldn't be much good for science fiction novels either, so writers had to look for ways to get round this difficulty. In 1915, Einstein showed that the effects of gravity could be described by supposing that space-time was warped or distorted by the matter and energy in it. And this theory is known as general relativity. We can actually observe this warping of space-time produced by the mass of the sun in the slight bending of light or radio waves passing close to the sun. This causes the apparent position of the star or radio source to shift slightly when the sun is between the Earth and the source. The shift is very small, about a thousandth of a degree, equivalent to a movement of an inch at a distance of a mile. Nevertheless, it can be measured with great accuracy, and it agrees with the predictions of general relativity. We have experimental evidence that space and time are warped. The amount of warping in our neighbourhood is very small because all the gravitational fields in the solar system are weak. However, we know that very strong fields can occur, for example, in the Big Bang or in black holes. So can space and time be warped enough to meet the demands from science fiction for things like hyperspace drives, wormholes, or time travel? At first sight, all these seem possible. For example, in 1948, Kurt Gödel found a solution to Einstein's field equations of general relativity that represents a universe in which all the matter was rotating. In this universe, it would be possible to go off in a spaceship and come back before you had set out. Gödel was at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, where Einstein also spent his last years. He was more famous for proving you couldn't prove everything that is true even in such an apparently simple subject as arithmetic. But what he proved about general relativity allowing time travel really upset Einstein, who had thought it wouldn't be possible. We now know that Gödel's solution couldn't represent the universe in which we live because it was not expanding. It also had a fairly large value for a quantity called the cosmological constant, which is generally believed to be very small. However, other apparently more reasonable solutions that allow time travel have since been found. A particularly interesting one from an approach known as string theory contains two cosmic strings moving past each other at a speed very near to but slightly less than the speed of light. Cosmic strings are a remarkable idea of theoretical physics which science fiction writers don't really seem to have caught on to. As their name suggests, they are like string in that they have length but a tiny cross-section. Actually, they're more like rubber bands because they are under enormous tension. Something like 100 billion 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 tons. A cosmic string attached to the sun would accelerate it from 0 to 60 in a 30th of a second. Cosmic strings may sound far-fetched and pure science fiction, but there are good scientific reasons to believe that they could have formed in the very early universe, shortly after the Big Bang. Because they are under such great tension, one might have expected them to accelerate to almost the speed of light. What both the girdle universe and the fast-moving cosmic string space-time have in common is that they start out so distorted and curved that space-time curves back on itself and travel into the past was always possible. God might have created such a warped universe, but we have no reason to think that he did. All the evidence is that the universe started out in the Big Bang without the kind of warping needed to allow travel into the past. Since we can't change the way the universe began, the question of whether time travel is possible is one of whether we can subsequently make space-time so warped that one can go back to the past. I think this is an important subject for research, but one has to be careful not to be labelled a crank. If one made a research grant application to work on time travel, it would be dismissed immediately. No government agency could afford to be seen to be spending public money on anything as way out as time travel. Instead, one has to use technical terms like closed time-like curves, which are code for time travel. Yet it is a very serious question. Since general relativity can permit time travel, does it allow it in our universe? And if not, why not? Closely related to time travel is the ability to travel rapidly from one position in space to another. As I said earlier, Einstein showed that it would take an infinite amount of rocket power to accelerate a spaceship to beyond the speed of light. So the only way to get from one side of the galaxy to the other in a reasonable time would seem to be if we could warp space-time so much that we created a little tube or wormhole. This could connect the two sides of the galaxy and act as a shortcut to get from one to the other and back while your friends were still alive. Such wormholes have been seriously suggested as being within the capabilities of a future civilization. But if you can travel from one side of the galaxy to the other in a week or two, you could go back through another wormhole and arrive back before you had set out. You could even manage to travel back in time with a single wormhole if its two ends were moving relative to each other. One can show that to create a wormhole, one needs to warp space-time in the opposite way to that in which normal matter warps it. Ordinary matter curves space-time back on itself like the surface of the Earth. However, to create a wormhole, one needs matter that warps space-time in the opposite way, like the surface of a saddle. The same is true of any other way of warping space-time to allow travel to the past if the universe didn't begin so warped that it allowed time travel. What one would need would be matter with negative mass and negative energy density to make space-time warp in the way required. Energy is rather like money. If you have a positive bank balance, you can distribute it in various ways. But according to the classical laws that were believed until quite recently, you weren't allowed to have an energy overdraft. So these classical laws would have ruled out us being able to warp the universe in the way required to allow time travel. However, the classical laws were overthrown by quantum theory, which is the other great revolution in our picture of the universe apart from general relativity. Quantum theory is more relaxed and allows you to have an overdraft on one or two accounts, if only the banks were as accommodating. In other words, quantum theory allows the energy density to be negative in some places, provided it is positive in others. The reason quantum theory can allow the energy density to be negative is that it is based on the uncertainty principle. This says that certain quantities, like the position and speed of a particle, can't both have well-defined values. The more accurately the position of a particle is defined, the greater is the uncertainty in its speed, and vice versa. The uncertainty principle also applies to fields like the electromagnetic field or the gravitational field. It implies that these fields can't be exactly zero, even in what we think of as empty space. For if they were exactly zero, their values would have both a well-defined position at zero and a well-defined speed, which was also zero. This would be a violation of the uncertainty principle. Instead, the fields would have to contain a certain minimum amount of fluctuations. One can interpret these so-called vacuum fluctuations as pairs of particles and antiparticles that suddenly appear together, move apart, and then come back together again and annihilate each other. These particle-antiparticle pairs are said to be virtual because one cannot measure them directly with a particle detector. However, one can observe their effects indirectly. One way of doing this is by what is called the Casimir effect. Imagine that you have two parallel metal plates a short distance apart. The plates act like mirrors for the virtual particles and antiparticles. This means that the region between the plates is a bit like an organ pipe and will only admit light waves of certain resonant frequencies. The result is that there are a slightly different number of vacuum fluctuations or virtual particles between the plates than there are outside them, where vacuum fluctuations can have any wavelength. The difference in the number of virtual particles between the plates, compared with outside the plates, means that they don't exert as much pressure on one side of the plates compared with the other. There is thus a slight force pushing the plates together. This force has been measured experimentally, so virtual particles actually exist and produce real effects. Because there are fewer virtual particles or vacuum fluctuations between the plates, they have a lower energy density than in the region outside. But the energy density of empty space far away from the plates must be zero. Otherwise it would warp space-time and the universe wouldn't be nearly flat. So the energy density in the region between the plates must be negative. We thus have experimental evidence from the bending of light that space-time is curved, and confirmation from the Casimir effect that we can warp it in the negative direction. So it might seem that as we advance in science and technology, we might be able to construct a wormhole or warp space and time in some other way so as to be able to travel into our past. If this were the case, it would raise a whole host of questions and problems. One of these is, if time travel would be possible in the future, why hasn't someone come back from the future to tell us how to do it? Even if there were sound reasons for keeping us in ignorance, human nature being what it is difficult to believe that someone wouldn't show off and tell us poor benighted peasants the secret of time travel. Of course, some people would claim that we already have been visited from the future. They would say that UFOs come from the future and that governments are engaged in a gigantic conspiracy to cover them up, and keep for themselves the scientific knowledge that these visitors bring. What I can say is that if governments were hiding something, they're doing a poor job of extracting useful information from the aliens. I'm pretty skeptical of conspiracy theories, as I believe the cock-up theory is more likely. The reports of sightings of UFOs cannot all be caused by extraterrestrials, because they are mutually contradictory. But once you admit that some are mistakes or hallucinations, isn't it more probable that they all are than that we are being visited by people from the future or from the other side of the galaxy? If they really want to colonize the Earth or warn us of some danger, they're being rather ineffective. A possible way to reconcile time travel with the fact that we don't seem to have any visitors from the future would be to say that such travel can occur only in the future. In this view, one would say space-time in our past was fixed because we have observed it, and seen that it is not warped enough to allow travel into the past. On the other hand, the future is open, so we might be able to warp it enough to allow time travel. But because we can warp space-time only in the future, we wouldn't be able to travel back to the present time or earlier. This picture would explain why we haven't been overrun by tourists from the future. But it would still leave plenty of paradoxes. Suppose it were possible to go off in a rocket ship and come back before you had set off. What would stop you blowing up the rocket on its launch pad, or otherwise preventing yourself from setting out in the first place? There are other versions of this paradox, like going back and killing your parents before you were born. But they are essentially equivalent. There seem to be two possible resolutions. One is what I shall call the consistent histories approach. It says that one has to find a consistent solution of the equations of physics, even if space-time is so warped that it is possible to travel into the past. On this view, you couldn't set out on the rocket ship to travel into the past unless you had already come back and failed to blow up the launch pad. It is a consistent picture, but it would imply that we were completely determined. We couldn't change our minds. So much for free will. The other possibility is what I call the alternative histories approach. It has been championed by the physicist David Deutsch, and it seems to have been what the creator of Back to the Future had in mind. In this view, in one alternative history, there would not have been any return from the future before the rocket set off, and so no possibility of it being blown up. But when the traveller returns from the future, he enters another alternative history. In this, the human race makes a tremendous effort to build a spaceship. But just before it is due to be launched, a similar spaceship appears from the other side of the galaxy and destroys it. David Deutsch claims support for the alternative histories approach from the sum over histories concept introduced by the physicist Richard Feynman. The idea is that according to quantum theory, the universe doesn't just have a unique single history. Instead, the universe has every single possible history, each with its own probability. There must be a possible history in which there is a lasting peace in the Middle East, though maybe the probability is low. In some histories, space-time will be so warped that objects like rockets will be able to travel into their pasts. But each history is complete and self-contained, describing not only the curved space-time, but also the objects in it. So a rocket cannot transfer to another alternative history when it comes round again. It is still in the same history, which has to be self-consistent. Thus, despite what Deutsch claims, I think the sum over history's idea supports the consistent history's hypothesis rather than the alternative history's idea. It thus seems that we are stuck with the consistent history's picture. However, this need not involve problems with determinism or free will if the probabilities are very small for histories in which space-time is so warped that time travel is possible over a macroscopic region. This is what I call the chronology protection conjecture. The laws of physics conspire to prevent time travel on a macroscopic scale. It seems that what happens is that when space-time gets warped almost enough to allow travel into the past, virtual particles can almost become real particles following closed trajectories. The density of the virtual particles and their energy become very large. This means that the probability of these histories is very low. Thus it seems there may be a chronology protection agency at work, making the world safe for historians. But this subject of space and time warps is still in its infancy. According to a unifying form of string theory known as M-theory, which is our best hope of uniting general relativity and quantum theory, space-time ought to have 11 dimensions, not just the 4 that we experience. The idea is that 7 of these 11 dimensions are curled up into a space so small that we don't notice them. On the other hand, the remaining 4 directions are fairly flat and are what we call space-time. If this picture is correct, it might be possible to arrange that the 4 flat directions get mixed up with the 7 highly curved or warped directions. What this would give rise to, we don't yet know, but it opens exciting possibilities. In conclusion, rapid space travel and travel back in time can't be ruled out according to our present understanding. They would cause great logical problems, so let's hope there's a chronology protection law to prevent people going back and killing their parents. But science fiction fans need not lose heart. There's hope in M-theory.
Is there any point in hosting a party for time travellers? Would you hope anyone would turn up?
In 2009, I held a party for time travelers in my college, Gonville and Keyes in Cambridge, for a film about time travel. To ensure that only genuine time travelers came, I didn't send out the invitations until after the party. On the day of the party, I sat in college hoping, but no one came. I was disappointed, but not surprised, because I had shown that if general relativity is correct, and energy density is positive, time travel is not possible. I would have been delighted if one of my assumptions had turned out to be wrong.
7. Will we survive on Earth? In January 2018, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a journal founded by some of the physicists who had worked on the Manhattan Project to produce the first atomic weapons, moved the doomsday clock, their measurement of the imminence of catastrophe, military or environmental, facing our planet, forward to 2 minutes to midnight. The clock has an interesting history. It was started in 1947, at a time when the atomic age had only just begun. Robert Oppenheimer, the chief scientist for the Manhattan Project, said later of the first explosion of an atomic bomb 2 years earlier in July 1945, "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, 'Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.'" In 1947, the clock was originally set at 7 minutes to midnight. It is now closer to doomsday than at any time since then, save in the early 1950s at the start of the Cold War. The clock and its movements are, of course, entirely symbolic, but I feel compelled to point out that such an alarming warning from other scientists, prompted at least in part by the election of Donald Trump, must be taken seriously. Is the clock, and the idea that time is ticking or even running out for the human race, realistic or alarmist? Is its warning timely or time-wasting? I have a very personal interest in time. Firstly, my best-selling book, and the main reason that I am known beyond the confines of the scientific community, was called A Brief History of Time. So some might imagine that I'm an expert on time, although, of course, these days an expert is not necessarily a good thing to be. Secondly, as someone who at the age of 21 was told by their doctors that they had only 5 years to live, and who turned 76 in 2018, I am an expert on time in another sense, a much more personal one. I am uncomfortably, acutely aware of the passage of time, and have lived much of my life with a sense that the time that I have been granted is, as they say, borrowed. It is without doubt the case that our world is more politically unstable than at any time in my memory. Large numbers of people feel left behind both economically and socially. As a result, they are turning to populist, or at least popular, politicians who have limited experience of government and whose ability to take calm decisions in a crisis has yet to be tested. So that would imply that a doomsday clock should be moved closer to a critical point, as the prospect of careless or malicious forces precipitating Armageddon grows. The Earth is under threat from so many areas that it is difficult for me to be positive. The threats are too big and too numerous. First, the Earth is becoming too small for us. Our physical resources are being drained at an alarming rate. We have presented our planet with the disastrous gift of climate change. Rising temperatures, reduction of the polar ice caps, deforestation, overpopulation, disease, war, famine, lack of water, and decimation of animal species. These are all solvable, but so far have not been solved. Global warming is caused by all of us. We want cars, travel, and a better standard of living. The trouble is, by the time people realize what is happening, it may be too late. As we stand on the brink of a second nuclear age and a period of unprecedented climate change, scientists have a special responsibility, once again, to inform the public and to advise leaders about the perils that humanity faces. As scientists, we understand the dangers of nuclear weapons and their devastating effects, and we are learning how human activities and technologies are affecting climate systems in ways that may forever change life on Earth. As citizens of the world, we have a duty to share that knowledge and to alert the public to the unnecessary risks that we live with every day. We foresee great peril if governments and societies do not take action now to render nuclear weapons obsolete and to prevent further climate change. At the same time, many of those same politicians are denying the reality of man-made climate change, or at least the ability of man to reverse it, just at the moment that our world is facing a series of critical environmental crises. The danger is that global warming may become self-sustaining, if it has not become so already. The melting of the Arctic and Antarctic ice caps reduces the fraction of solar energy reflected back into space, and so increases the temperature further. Climate change may kill off the Amazon and other rainforests, and so eliminate one of the main ways in which carbon dioxide is removed from the atmosphere. The rise in sea temperature may trigger the release of large quantities of carbon dioxide. Both these phenomena would increase the greenhouse effect and so exacerbate global warming. Both effects could make our climate like that of Venus, boiling hot and raining sulfuric acid, but with a temperature of 250 degrees Celsius. Human life would be unsustainable. We need to go beyond the Kyoto Protocol, the international agreement adopted in 1997, and cut carbon emissions now. We have the technology. We just need the political will. We can be an ignorant, unthinking lot. When we have reached similar crises in our history, there has usually been somewhere else to colonize. Columbus did it in 1492 when he discovered the New World. But now there is no New World, no utopia around the corner. We are running out of space, and the only places to go are to other worlds. The universe is a violent place. Stars engulf planets, supernovae fire lethal rays across space, black holes bump into each other and asteroids hurtle around at hundreds of miles a second. Granted, these phenomena do not make space sound very inviting, but these are the very reasons why we should venture into space instead of staying put. An asteroid collision would be something against which we have no defense. The last such big collision with us was about 66 million years ago, and that is thought to have killed the dinosaurs, and it will happen again. This is not science fiction. It is guaranteed by the laws of physics and probability. Nuclear war is still probably the greatest threat to humanity at the present time. It is a danger we have rather forgotten. Russia and the United States are no longer so trigger-happy, but suppose there's an accident, or terrorists get hold of the weapons these countries still have, and the risk increases the more countries obtain nuclear weapons. Even after the end of the Cold War, there are still enough nuclear weapons stockpiled to kill us all, several times over. And new nuclear nations will add to the instability. With time, the nuclear threat may decrease, but other threats will develop. So we must remain on our guard. One way or another, I regard it as almost inevitable that either a nuclear confrontation or environmental catastrophe will cripple the Earth at some point in the next 1,000 years, which, as geological time goes, is the mere blink of an eye. By then I hope and believe that our ingenious race will have found a way to slip the surly bonds of Earth and will therefore survive the disaster. The same, of course, may not be possible for the millions of other species that inhabit the Earth, and that will be on our conscience as a race. I think we are acting with reckless indifference to our future on planet Earth. At the moment, we have nowhere else to go. But in the long run, the human race shouldn't have all its eggs in one basket, or on one planet. I just hope we can avoid dropping the basket before we learn how to escape from Earth. We are, by nature, explorers, motivated by curiosity. This is a uniquely human quality. It is this driven curiosity that sent explorers to prove the Earth is not flat, and it is the same instinct that sends us to the stars at the speed of thought, urging us to go there in reality. And whenever we make a great new leap, such as the moon landings, we elevate humanity, bring people and nations together, usher in new discoveries and new technologies. To leave Earth demands a concerted global approach. Everyone should join in. We need to rekindle the excitement of the early days of space travel in the 1960s. The technology is almost within our grasp. It is time to explore other solar systems. Spreading out may be the only thing that saves us from ourselves. I am convinced that humans need to leave Earth. If we stay, we risk being annihilated. So, beyond my hope for space exploration, what will the future look like and how might science help us? The popular picture of science in the future is shown in science fiction series like Star Trek. The producers of Star Trek even persuaded me to take part, not that it was difficult. That appearance was great fun, but I mention it to make a serious point. Nearly all the visions of the future that we've been shown from H.G. Wells onwards have been essentially static. They show a society that is in most cases far in advance of ours in science, in technology, and in political organisation. The last might not be difficult. In the period between now and then, there must have been great changes, with their accompanying tensions and upsets. But by the time we are shown the future, science, technology, and the organisation of society are supposed to have achieved a level of near perfection. I question this picture, and ask if we will ever reach a final, steady state of science and technology. At no time in the 10,000 years or so since the last Ice Age has the human race been in a state of constant knowledge and fixed technology. There have been a few setbacks, like what we used to call the Dark Ages after the fall of the Roman Empire. But the world's population, which is a measure of our technological ability to preserve life and feed ourselves, has risen steadily with a few hiccups, like the Black Death. In the last 200 years, the growth has at times been exponential, and the world population has jumped from 1 billion to about 7.6 billion. Other measures of technological development in recent times are electricity consumption, or the number of scientific articles. They too show near exponential growth. Indeed, we now have such heightened expectations that some people feel cheated by politicians and scientists because we have not already achieved the utopian visions of the future. For example, the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, showed us with a base on the moon and launching a manned, or should I say, personed, flight to Jupiter. There is no sign that scientific and technological development will dramatically slow down and stop in the near future. Certainly not by the time of Star Trek, which is only about 350 years away. But the present rate of growth cannot continue for the next millennium. By the year 2600, the world's population would be standing shoulder to shoulder, and the electricity consumption would make the Earth glow red hot. If you stacked the new books being published next to each other at the present rate of production, you would have to move at 90 miles an hour just to keep up with the end of the line. Of course, by 2600, new artistic and scientific work will come in electronic forms rather than as physical books and papers. Nevertheless, if the exponential growth continued, there would be 10 papers a second in my kind of theoretical physics, and no time to read them. Clearly the present exponential growth cannot continue indefinitely. So what will happen? One possibility is that we will wipe ourselves out through some disaster such as a nuclear war. Even if we don't destroy ourselves completely, there is the possibility that we might descend into a state of brutalism and barbarity, like the opening scene of Terminator. How will we develop in science and technology over the next millennium? This is very difficult to answer, but let me stick my neck out and offer my predictions for the future. I will have some chance of being right about the next 100 years, but the rest of the millennium will be wild speculation. Our modern understanding of science began about the same time as the European settlement of North America. And by the end of the 19th century, it seemed that we were about to achieve a complete understanding of the universe in terms of what are now known as classical laws. But as we have seen, in the 20th century, observations began to show that energy came in discrete packets called quanta, and a new kind of theory called quantum mechanics was formulated by Max Planck and others. This presented a completely different picture of reality, in which things don't have a single unique history, but have every possible history, each with its own probability. When one goes down to the individual particles, the possible particle histories have to include paths that travel faster than light, and even paths that go back in time. However, these paths that go back in time are not just like angels dancing on a pin. They have real, observational consequences. Even what we think of as empty space is full of particles moving in closed loops in space and time. That is, they move forwards in time on one side of the loop, and backwards in time on the other side. The awkward thing is that because there's an infinite number of points in space and time, there's an infinite number of possible closed loops of particles. And an infinite number of closed loops of particles would have an infinite amount of energy and would curl space and time up to a single point. Even science fiction did not think of anything as odd as this. Dealing with this infinite energy requires some really creative accounting, and much of the work in theoretical physics in the last 20 years has been looking for a theory in which the infinite number of closed loops in space and time cancel each other completely. Only then will we be able to unify quantum theory with Einstein's general relativity and achieve a complete theory of the basic laws of the universe. What are the prospects that we will discover this complete theory in the next millennium? I would say they were very good, but then I'm an optimist. In 1980, I said I thought there was a 50-50 chance that we would discover a complete unified theory in the next 20 years. We have made some remarkable progress in the period since then, but the final theory seems about the same distance away. Will the holy grail of physics be always just beyond our reach? I think not. At the beginning of the 20th century, we understood the workings of nature on the scales of classical physics that are good down to about 1/100 of a millimeter. The work on atomic physics in the first 30 years of the century took our understanding down to lengths of 1/1000000th of a millimeter. Since then, research on nuclear and high-energy physics has taken us to length scales that are smaller by a further factor of 1 billion. It might seem that we could go on forever discovering structures on smaller and smaller length scales. However, there is a limit to this series, as with a series of nested Russian dolls. Eventually, one gets down to a smallest doll, which can't be taken apart anymore. In physics, the smallest doll is called the Planck length, and is 1 millimeter divided by 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000. We are not about to build particle accelerators that can probe to distances that small. They would have to be larger than the solar system, and they are not likely to be approved in the present financial climate. However, there are consequences of our theories that can be tested by much more modest machines. It won't be possible to probe down to the Planck length in the laboratory, though we can study the Big Bang to get observational evidence at higher energies and shorter length scales than we can achieve on Earth. However, to a large extent, we shall have to rely on mathematical beauty and consistency to find the ultimate theory of everything. The Star Trek vision of the future, in which we achieve an advanced but essentially static level, may come true in respect of our knowledge of the basic laws that govern the universe, but I don't think we will ever reach a steady state in the uses we make of these laws. The ultimate theory will place no limit on the complexity of systems that we can produce, and it is in this complexity that I think the most important development of the next millennium will be. By far the most complex systems that we have are our own bodies. Life seems to have originated in the primordial oceans that covered the Earth 4 billion years ago. How this happened, we don't know. It may be that random collisions between atoms built up macromolecules that could reproduce themselves and assemble themselves into more complicated structures. What we do know is that by 3.5 billion years ago, the highly complicated molecule DNA had emerged. DNA is the basis for all life on Earth. It has a double helix structure, like a spiral staircase, which was discovered by Francis Crick and James Watson in the Cavendish lab at Cambridge in 1953. The two strands of the double helix are linked by pairs of nucleic acids, like the treads in a spiral staircase. There are four kinds of nucleic acids, cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine. The order in which the different nucleic acids occur along the spiral staircase carries the genetic information that enables the DNA molecule to assemble an organism around it and reproduce itself. As the DNA made copies of itself, there would have been occasional errors in the order of the nucleic acids along the spiral. In most cases, the mistakes in copying would have made the DNA unable to reproduce itself. Such genetic errors, or mutations as they are called, would die out. But in a few cases, the error or mutation would increase the chances of the DNA surviving and reproducing. Thus, the information content in the sequence of nucleic acids would gradually evolve and increase in complexity. This natural selection of mutations was first proposed by another Cambridge man, Charles Darwin, in 1858, though he didn't know the mechanism for it. Because biological evolution is basically a random walk in the space of all genetic possibilities, it has been very slow. The complexity or number of bits of information that are coded in DNA is given roughly by the number of nucleic acids in the molecule. Each bit of information can be thought of as the answer to a yes-no question. For the first 2 billion years or so, the rate of increase in complexity must have been of the order of 1 bit of information every 100 years. The rate of increase of DNA complexity gradually rose to about 1 bit a year over the last few million years. But now we're at the beginning of a new era, in which we will be able to increase the complexity of our DNA without having to wait for the slow process of biological evolution. There has been relatively little change in human DNA in the last 10,000 years, but it is likely that we will be able to redesign it completely in the next 1,000. Of course, many people will say that genetic engineering on humans should be banned, but I rather doubt that they will be able to prevent it. Genetic engineering on plants and animals will be allowed for economic reasons, and someone is bound to try it on humans. Unless we have a totalitarian world order, someone will design improved humans somewhere. Clearly, developing improved humans will create great social and political problems with respect to unimproved humans. I am not advocating human genetic engineering as a good thing. I'm just saying that it is likely to happen in the next millennium, whether we want it to or not. This is why I don't believe science fiction like Star Trek, where people are essentially the same 350 years in the future. I think the human race and its DNA will increase its complexity quite rapidly. In a way, the human race needs to improve its mental and physical qualities if it is to deal with the increasingly complex world around it and meet new challenges like space travel. And it also needs to increase its complexity if biological systems are to keep ahead of electronic ones. At the moment, computers have an advantage of speed, but they show no sign of intelligence. This is not surprising because our present computers are less complex than the brain of an earthworm, a species not noted for its intellectual powers. But computers roughly obey a version of Moore's law, which says that their speed and complexity double every 18 months. It is one of these exponential growths that clearly cannot continue indefinitely. And indeed, it has already begun to slow. However, the rapid pace of improvement will probably continue until computers have a similar complexity to the human brain. Some people say that computers can never show true intelligence, whatever that may be. But it seems to me that if very complicated chemical molecules can operate in humans to make them intelligent, then equally complicated electronic circuits can also make computers act in an intelligent way. And if they are intelligent, they can presumably design computers that have even greater complexity and intelligence. This is why I don't believe the science fiction picture of an advanced but constant future. Instead, I expect complexity to increase at a rapid rate, in both the biological and the electronic spheres. Not much of this will happen in the next 100 years, which is all we can reliably predict. But by the end of the next millennium, if we get there, the change will be fundamental. Lincoln Steffens once said, "I have seen the future, and it works." He was actually talking about the Soviet Union, which we now know didn't work very well. Nevertheless, I think the present world order has a future, but it will be very different.
What is the biggest threat to the future of this planet?
An asteroid collision would be a threat against which we have no defense. But the last big such asteroid collision was about 66 million years ago and killed the dinosaurs. A more immediate danger is runaway climate change. A rise in ocean temperature would melt the ice caps and cause a release of large amounts of carbon dioxide. Both effects could make our climate like that of Venus, with a temperature of 250 degrees.
8. Should we colonize space? Why should we go into space? What is the justification for spending all that effort and money on getting a few lumps of moon rock? Aren't there better causes here on Earth? The obvious answer is because it's there, all around us. Not to leave planet Earth would be like castaways on a desert island not trying to escape. We need to explore the solar system to find out where humans could live. In a way, the situation is like that in Europe before 1492. People might well have argued that it was a waste of money to send Columbus on a wild goose chase. Yet the discovery of the New World made a profound difference to the old. Just think, we wouldn't have had the Big Mac or KFC. Spreading out into space will have an even greater effect. It will completely change the future of the human race and maybe determine whether we have any future at all. It won't solve our immediate problems on planet Earth, but it will give us a new perspective on them and cause us to look outwards rather than inwards. Hopefully, it will unite us to face the common challenge. This would be a long-term strategy, and by long-term I mean hundreds or even thousands of years. We could have a base on the Moon within 30 years, reach Mars in 50 years, and explore the moons of the outer planets in 200 years. By reach, I mean in spacecraft with humans aboard. We have already driven rovers on Mars and landed a probe on Titan, a moon of Saturn, but if we are considering the future of the human race, we have to go there ourselves. Going into space won't be cheap, but it would take only a small proportion of world resources. NASA's budget has remained roughly constant in real terms since the time of the Apollo landings. But it has decreased from 0.3% of US GDP in 1970 to about 0.1% in 2017. Even if we were to increase the international budget 20 times to make a serious effort to go into space, it would only be a small fraction of world GDP. There will be those who argue that it would be better to spend our money solving the problems of this planet, like climate change and pollution, rather than wasting it on a possibly fruitless search for a new planet. I'm not denying the importance of fighting climate change and global warming, but we can do that and still spare a quarter of a percent of world GDP for space. Isn't our future worth a quarter of a percent? We thought space was worth a big effort in the 1960s. In 1962, President Kennedy committed the US to landing a man on the moon by the end of the decade. On 20th of July, 1969, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong landed on the surface of the moon. It changed the future of the human race. I was 27 at the time, a researcher at Cambridge, and I missed it. I was at a meeting on singularities in Liverpool and listening to a lecture by René Thom on catastrophe theory when the landing took place. There was no catch-up TV in those days and we didn't have a television, but my son, aged 2, described it to me. The space race helped to create a fascination with science and accelerated our technological progress. Many of today's scientists were inspired to go into science as a result of the moon landings, with the aim of understanding more about ourselves and our place in the universe. It gave us new perspectives on our world, prompting us to consider the planet as a whole. However, after the last moon landing in 1972, with no future plans for further manned spaceflight, public interest in space declined. This went along with a general disenchantment with science in the West, because although it had brought great benefits, it had not solved the social problems that increasingly occupied public attention. A new crewed spaceflight program would do a lot to restore public enthusiasm for space and for science generally. Robotic missions are much cheaper and may provide more scientific information, but they don't catch the public imagination in the same way, and they don't spread the human race into space, which I'm arguing should be our long-term strategy. A goal of a base on the moon by 2050 and of a manned landing on Mars by 2070 would reignite the space program and give it a sense of purpose, in the same way that President Kennedy's moon target did in the 1960s. In late 2017, Elon Musk announced SpaceX plans for a lunar base and a Mars mission by 2022, and President Trump signed a space policy directive refocusing NASA on exploration and discovery. So perhaps we'll get there even sooner. A new interest in space would also increase the public standing of science generally. The low esteem in which science and scientists are held is having serious consequences. We live in a society that is increasingly governed by science and technology, yet fewer and fewer young people want to go into science. A new and ambitious space program would excite the young and stimulate them into entering a wide range of sciences, not just astrophysics and space science. The same is true for me. I've always dreamed of spaceflight, but for so many years I thought it was just that, a dream. Confined to Earth and in a wheelchair, how could I experience the majesty of space except through imagination and my work in theoretical physics? I never thought I would have the opportunity to see our beautiful planet from space, or gaze out into the infinity beyond. This was the domain of astronauts, the lucky few who get to experience the wonder and thrill of spaceflight. But I had not factored in the energy and enthusiasm of individuals whose mission it is to take that first step in venturing outside Earth. And in 2007, I was fortunate enough to go on a zero-gravity flight and experience weightlessness for the first time. It only lasted for 4 minutes, but it was amazing. I could have gone on and on. I was quoted at the time as saying that I feared the human race is not going to have a future if we don't go into space. I believed it then, and I believe it still. And I hope I demonstrated then that anyone can take part in space travel. I believe it is up to scientists like me, together with innovative commercial entrepreneurs, to do all we can to promote the excitement and wonder of space travel. But can humans exist for long periods away from the Earth? Our experience with the ISS, the International Space Station, shows that it is possible for human beings to survive for many months away from planet Earth. However, the zero gravity of orbit causes a number of undesirable physiological changes, including a weakening of the bones, as well as creating practical problems with liquids and so on. One would therefore want any long-term base for human beings to be on a planet or moon. By digging into the surface, one would get thermal insulation and protection from meteors and cosmic rays. The planet or moon could also serve as a source of the raw materials that would be needed if the extraterrestrial community was to be self-sustaining, independent of Earth. What are the possible sites of a human colony in the solar system? The most obvious is the moon. It is close by and relatively easy to reach. We have already landed on it and driven across it in a buggy. On the other hand, the moon is small, without atmosphere or a magnetic field to deflect the solar radiation particles like on Earth. There is no liquid water, although there may be ice in the craters at the North and South Poles. A colony on the moon could use this as a source of oxygen, with power provided by nuclear energy or solar panels. The moon could be a base for travel to the rest of the solar system. Mars is the obvious next target. It is half as far again as the Earth from the sun, and so receives half the warmth. It once had a magnetic field, but it decayed 4 billion years ago, leaving Mars without protection from solar radiation. This stripped Mars of most of its atmosphere, leaving it with only 1% of the pressure of the Earth's atmosphere. However, the pressure must have been higher in the past because we see what appears to be runoff channels and dried-up lakes. Liquid water cannot exist on the surface of Mars now. It would vaporize in the near vacuum. This suggests that Mars had a warm, wet period, during which life might have appeared, either spontaneously or through panspermia, that is, brought from somewhere else in the universe. There is no sign of life on Mars now, but if we found evidence that life had once existed, it would indicate that the probability of life developing on a suitable planet was fairly high. We must be careful, though, that we don't confuse the issue by contaminating the planet with life from Earth. Similarly, we must be very careful not to bring back any Martian life. We would have no resistance to it, and it might wipe out life on Earth. NASA has sent a large number of spacecraft to Mars, starting with Mariner 4 in 1964. It has surveyed the planet with a number of orbiters, the latest being the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. These orbiters have revealed deep gullies and the highest mountains in the solar system. NASA has also landed a number of probes on the surface of Mars, most recently the 2 Mars rovers. These have sent back pictures of a dry desert landscape. Like on the moon, water and oxygen might be obtainable from polar ice. There has been volcanic activity on Mars. This would have brought minerals and metals to the surface, which a colony could use. the Moon and Mars are the most suitable sites for space colonies in the solar system. Mercury and Venus are too hot, while Jupiter and Saturn are gas giants with no solid surface. The moons of Mars are very small and have no advantages over Mars itself. Some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn might be possible. Europa, a moon of Jupiter, has a frozen ice surface, but there may be liquid water under the surface in which life could have developed. How can we find out? Do we have to land on Europa and drill a hole? Titan, a moon of Saturn, is larger and more massive than our moon and has a dense atmosphere. The Cassini-Huygens mission of NASA and the European Space Agency has landed a probe on Titan which has sent back pictures of the surface. However, it is very cold, being so far from the sun, and I wouldn't fancy living next to a lake of liquid methane. But what about boldly going beyond the solar system? Our observations indicate that a significant fraction of stars have planets around them. So far, we can detect only giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn, but it is reasonable to assume that they will be accompanied by smaller Earth-like planets. Some of these will lie in the Goldilocks zone, where the distance from the star is in the right range for liquid water to exist on their surface. There are around 1,000 stars within 30 light-years of Earth. If 1% of these have Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone, we have 10 candidate new worlds. Take Proxima B, for example. This exoplanet, which is the closest to Earth, but still 4.5 light-years away, orbits the star Proxima Centauri, within the solar system Alpha Centauri, and recent research indicates that it has some similarities to Earth. Travelling to these candidate worlds isn't possible, perhaps, with today's technology, but by using our imagination we can make interstellar travel a long-term aim, in the next 200 to 500 years. The speed at which we can send a rocket is governed by two things, the speed of the exhaust and the fraction of its mass that the rocket loses as it accelerates. The exhaust speed of chemical rockets, like the ones we've used so far, is about 3 kilometers per second. By jettisoning 30% of their mass, they can achieve a speed of about 0.5 kilometers per second and then slow down again. According to NASA, it would take as little as 260 days to reach Mars, give or take 10 days, with some NASA scientists predicting as little as 130 days. But it would take 3 million years to get to the nearest star system. To go faster would require a much higher exhaust speed than chemical rockets can provide, that of light itself. A powerful beam of light from the rear could drive the spaceship forward. Nuclear fusion could provide 1% of the spaceship's mass energy, which would accelerate it to 1/10 of the speed of light. Beyond that, we would need either matter-antimatter annihilation or some completely new form of energy. In fact, the distance to Alpha Centauri is so great that to reach it in a human lifetime, a spacecraft would have to carry fuel with roughly the mass of all the stars in the galaxy. In other words, with current technology, interstellar travel is utterly impractical. Alpha Centauri can never become a holiday destination. We have a chance to change that, thanks to imagination and ingenuity. In 2016, I joined with the entrepreneur Yuri Milner to launch Breakthrough Starshot, a long-term research and development program aimed at making interstellar travel a reality. If we succeed, we will send a probe to Alpha Centauri within the lifetime of people alive today. But I will return to this shortly. How do we start this journey? So far, our explorations have been limited to our local cosmic neighborhood. 40 years on, our most intrepid explorer, Voyager, has just made it to interstellar space. Its speed, 11 miles a second, means it would take about 70,000 years to reach Alpha Centauri. This constellation is 4.37 light-years away, 25 trillion miles. If there are beings alive on Alpha Centauri today, they remain blissfully ignorant of the rise of Donald Trump. It is clear we are entering a new space age. The first private astronauts will be pioneers, and the first flights will be hugely expensive, but over time it is my hope that spaceflight will become within the reach of far more of the Earth's population. taking more and more passengers into space will bring new meaning to our place on Earth and to our responsibilities as its stewards. And it will help us to recognize our place and future in the cosmos, which is where I believe our ultimate destiny lies. Breakthrough Starshot is a real opportunity for man to make early